Okay. This week is Parsha Shlach, and we're going to look at the main story that's in the Parsha, which is concerning the spies. And the spies, it's a fascinating tale in the sense that we can ask a very simple question. What went wrong? When you look at the very beginning of the Parsha, so we're told, firstly, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'mor, that Hashem said to Moshe, Shlach lecha anashim, send. Lecha means for you, right? Shlach lecha, Rashi says, l'da'atcha. Ani eini mitzav alach im tirtzeh shlach. Like, it's optional, it's up to you. If you want to do it, great, but it's up to you. But at the same time, I mean, God really doesn't, that's Rashi, but what does the Pasuk say? The Pasuk says, shlach lecha anashim, send for yourself men, v'yasuru as Eretz Kanan, that they should essentially spy out the land. Asher ani no sein l'bnei Yisrael, that I'm giving to the Bnei Yisrael. One man per tribe. So if we can ask a very simple question. If God hadn't said this to Moshe, would Moshe have sent spies? No, we don't know the answer to that question. Okay, but this is clearly initiated by God. So why is Moshe blamed for what ends up happening? Now, obviously, you know, the buck stops with the leadership, and the leadership is supposed to rein in the people that he ultimately sends. God doesn't send the people, Moshe sends the people. So Moshe is supposed to tell them, hey guys, when you come back, you're going to report to me and to me only and not to anybody else and make sure that your information comes to me so I can process it and figure out what to do. And whatever is gleaned from whatever you say, I will happily share with the people, and it does not have to come like a town hall, right? A town hall where you make a presentation and people get upset, which is what happens in a town hall. Hey, we don't need that. So Moshe goes ahead, and he does so, and it gives us the list of everybody. We're told also about that Hoshea bin Nun's name was changed to Yehoshua. That has interesting repercussions when it comes to how we understand Yehoshua as being presented in other parts of the Torah, simply because if this is the point in time when Moshe changes his name, the fact of the matter is that we have never heard his name as being Hoshea before now. He's always been Yehoshua. And is that, you know, Moshe, let's say, in retrospect, at the end of his life, when he's writing down the words of the Torah, is he just throwing a little yud in there to make sure that we know that the person who at an earlier time in the Torah was known as Hoshea is the same guy who we ultimately come to know as Yehoshua? So that's an interesting discussion. But I don't want to get lost in that. So if you go to Pasuk Yitzayin, you'll see, Vayishlach osam Moshe l'asur Saris Kanan. So sure enough, Moshe does send them to, you know, l'asur, l'tur, can mean different things, but we typically understand it mean to essentially spy out the land. Vayomer Elihem, and he says to them the following, and he gives them instructions, Aluzeh b'negev alisem esahar. Okay, and I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm just going to read them in English. Let's see. Go up through the south and climb the mountain. See the land. How is it? And the people that dwell in it, are they strong or are they weak? Are they few or are they numerous? And how is the land itself in which they dwell? Is it a good land or is it a bad land? In other words, can we farm on it? And how are the cities in which it dwells? Are they open or are they fortified? Right? Are they easily attackable, conquerable, etc.? And how is the land? Is it fertile or lean? That's actually interesting. What is the difference between those two questions? Umaha aretz asher hu yoshev ba tovahi imra'a. If that question is asking, is it good or bad? Like, what does that mean? Okay. And the second question is umaha aretz hashmeinahi imraza. Is it fertile or is it lean? So maybe that's a question which is asking. Is the first one a question of aesthetics? The second one's asking about farming. Is it a different kind of question about what is the definition of a good? I'm not really sure, honestly. Next, are there trees in it or not? You shall strengthen yourselves and take from the fruit of the land. Okay, so that's where it is. And the days were the season of the first ripe grapes. So what does that mean also? If you go to Israel now, for example, you know when the grapes are really becoming ripe. It's usually towards the end of the summer when it's the first ripe grapes. So I don't know what that means, because our tradition is that they came back on Tisha B'Av, and that they gave a reason for the people of Israel to cry on Tisha B'Av. And that's considered the first bichia, the first cry, which is the premonition to the bichia ledoros, to the crying that we have for all generations on Tisha B'Av. So I'm not sure what to make of the v'hayamim yimei bikurei anavim, It's the time of the maybe Bikurei Anavim means when they first become appearing. Like the article translates it, the first ripe grapes. I don't know. Bikurim, like we know what Bikurim means. Bikurim means the first fruit. So it could be like the first, when the grapes are beginning to appear. So it's the beginning of the summer. Okay, that makes a little more sense rather than saying the first ripe grape. Ripe means ready to eat. So maybe that's not the best translation. Okay, anyway. So they go up and they do exactly what Moshe has instructed them. And he gives us a lot of details. And it talks about how they come back bringing these fruits, some of which were very large. They came back, Pasuk Chavei 25, and they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, and they came to Moshe and Aaron and to the entire assembly. Right? And they go ahead and they show them everything. They show them the fruit. They sapru lo, and they tell them over the story. And they say, "Banu el arz asher shlachtanu, we came to the land to which you have sent us. V'gam zavas chalav udvash hi v'zer priyat. It is indeed a land flowing with milk and honey." So maybe that's the question of what a good land is, a land that flows with milk and honey. In other words, it has, in addition to the land being fertile, it has supplies. There's goodness in the land, okay, as opposed to just, you know, can we farm there? And of course, our understanding in general of the Eretz zavas chalav udvash, that the devash that we're talking about is not bee honey, it's date honey. And so that is another idea to have in mind. And then they say Efes Gazav. Now, according to the Ramban, pretty well known, Efes is the sin of the spies. When they say, "For it is not," or as our article translates it, "but." Okay, because you typically know if somebody's giving a compliment and then they say, "but," that kind of negates everything which came beforehand. Like, it was nice, but. How is the date honey? She was nice, but he was, you know, it was nice. He was okay, but. So we know where that's going. Efes is what they say. And then what do they say? They say, "Ki azam yoshe ba'aretz ve'erim tzuros k'dolos b'od, g'amilei de'anak v'nisham." The people that dwell in it are powerful. The cities are fortified, very great. We also saw that they're offsprings of the Anak, whatever that means, the giant. Amalek is in the south, and they list a whole bunch of nations that are there. And all this is basically a frightening tale. Okay, now, had they come in, had they said this to Moshe, so Moshe says, "All right, that's fine. Let's talk with our generals. Let's talk with our strategists, and let's figure out what to do." But the problem is that they said all this in front of the Bnei Israel. They went straight to the lion's mouth instead of going through what should have been proper channels. And of course, Moshe didn't rein them in. So as a result, Moshe, on the one hand, is criticized, in some cases very heavily. And on the other hand, of course, the spies, they get their own comeuppance, because they die pretty soon thereafter, with the exception, of course, of Kalev and Yehoshua. Now, when you look at Pasuk Lamed, so what you see is, "Vayahas Kalev esa'am el Moshe." Kalev takes a stand and he says, "No, alona alev yarashnu asuk, yachol nuchala. Let's go up and take it, we can." Now, hold on a second. You know, we just heard from Kalev. We would assume to hear from Yehoshua at this point in time. But Yehoshua doesn't say anything, which is very curious in the scheme of things. And the people who were with him, they said, "No, we can't do it. Ki chazaku mimenu, they're too big." This is a land which consumes its inhabitants. All those we saw in it were huge. Actually, that's an interesting question. What does anshei midos mean? Does anshei midos mean people of large measurements? Or does anshei midos mean people of stellar character? Right? When we think about midos, we're not talking about people's size. We're talking about their character traits. So what does it mean, anshei midos? All right, that's an interesting question. But I want to focus on Yehoshua and Kalev, but I just wanted to note that. Okay? V'sham ra'inu es ha'nefilim b'nei anak v'nei nefilim v'nehi b'neinu k'achagavim v'chein ha'inu b'neihem. So, I mean, look at what they say about themselves. We were like grasshoppers in our eyes and also in their eyes. Now, it's crazy. You know, how would they know how these Nephilim view them? Now, Rashi says they heard the Nephilim say to one another that there are Nimalim, that there are ants in the vineyards that look like men. So, you know, the Sifsei Chacham actually asked this question. He says, if they were like grasshoppers, which is the word that they use, chagavim, then why would Rashi say that they're like ants? So a few answers to that question. So, but they're also deeper. In other words, it's not just a question of, subtlety, nuance of ant versus grasshopper. So, one view is that the smaller person always thinks he's bigger than how the bigger person perceives him. The bigger person might always view the smaller person as even smaller than the smaller person perceives himself. Okay? So the text of Rashi sometimes includes the word that they heard the Nephilim use to describe them in the Torah, Chagavim, is in parentheses next to Nimalim. And so that's why there are differences of opinion as to what Rashi wrote, even though the standard text is Rashi using the word for ants. But Rashi is actually quoting a Gemara in Sota that says the spies were looking around, and when the locals spotted them, they hid in trees. And at that point, they heard the Nephilim say, "We've seen men that look like kamtzei, hiding in trees." Now, what are kamtzei? Kamtzei might be locusts, they might be ants, they might be snails. But either way, Chaskuni says when the Torah used the word chagavim, it's not a direct quote of what they said, because the term chagavim is used elsewhere as well to refer to small critters. There's a pasuk in Yeshaya chapter 40 which indicates that. So I don't know that it really matters how we translate the term. You know, they were quoting others who said that they looked like tiny creatures, but the Kutzker Rebbe says it's one of their greatest flaws. It's one thing to come back with a negative report. It's another thing to say that you view yourself as a lowly person in comparison to others. But the Kutzker Rebbe asks, what gives you the right to give any kind of consideration to how others view you? What do you care what they think? So it's a lesson in just being comfortable in your own skin, which is something that the spies, you know, somehow neglected and somehow lost in this context. But more than that, what ended up coming as a result is the response. But he saw kol hayda vayitnu es kolam vayivku al v'layla. As I mentioned before, this is the concern. This is the bechia, the cry, which takes place at this time. And that becomes the impetus for the bechia l'doros, for the cry for generations. So they complained to Moshe. So this is a common complaint whenever things don't go their way. They say, you know, we should go back to Egypt. We saw that in last week's parsha. I mean, not in our class, but in last week's parsha. The idea of, oh yeah, we remember all the food that we had, you know, the fish that we had in Egypt and the different vegetables which we had in Egypt. Things were so much better there. So that's a common complaint that they often revert back to. And when I say they, I don't mean all of Bnei Israel, but it's obviously a faction of Bnei Israel who are doing this. And it's at this point in time, at this point in time that Moshe and Aaron essentially give up. They give up, and then we see Yehoshua stepping up. Okay, so up until Parak Yudalad, Pasuk Vav, we have not seen Yehoshua at all. We see Yehoshua ben Nun, Yechalei ben Yifuneh, and Atarim Sa'aretz Karu Vigdehem. So where was Yehoshua? Earlier we saw Kalev take a stand. And then Kalev was presented to us in contrast to the Anashim Asher Elu'imo, the men who went up with him. So was Yehoshua part of the Anashim Asher Elu'imo, or was Yehoshua, you know, kind of on the fences, not really sure where to go? We have to remember that, I mean, we know just from last week's parsha alone, aside from other hints to us in the text, or I mean straight out of the text, that Yehoshua had a very special relationship with Moshe. So it's hard to imagine that Yehoshua would be part of the group of spies that are against Moshe. Okay, but he's not mentioned separately in the same way that Kalev was mentioned separately. So I like to think that Yehoshua was on the fences. In other words, Yehoshua was processing the information that he had seen in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan, and he wasn't sure what to do with it. And he sees, you know, on the one hand, because, you know, it's so easy to fall in line with the mob Maybe Yehoshua was one of the younger ones. I don't know. We don't know their ages. I mean, we have an idea of Kalev's age, but that's only from looking backwards in the book of Shoftim. Or, I'm sorry, I think it's in both Yehoshua and in the very beginning of Shoftim, where we see Kalev being mentioned. But certainly in the book of Yehoshua, rather. And the idea being that we know how old Kalev is. Basically, he's 45 at this time. And Yehoshua, we know how old he is when they get into the land. So they're basically the same age. So the other ones, we don't know their ages because we don't know anything about them other than this story. So is Yehoshua on the fences? And now that Kalev takes a stand, he says, okay, fine. Now I see that there's an alternate view, and I'm going to jump on the bandwagon of that alternate view, even though it's unpopular. Okay? Which is fascinating. Right? It's amazing. Because this happens today also, right? There's a very popular opinion. Who knows what's right or wrong? And the unpopular opinion is shunned. And maybe sometimes the unpopular opinion is correct. I don't know. But it certainly is not given the time of day as it may often need to be. And this story vindicates this kind of idea. The Torah rather vindicates this kind of idea all the time, where you have a mob, and they say one thing. And that's clearly the popular opinion. It's the flavor du jour of the day, and it turns out that it's incorrect, and it's the people who stand against it who end up being the heroes. So it's kind of fascinating how those kinds of things work. But anyway, so Yehoshua joins with Kalev, and we're told Yehoshua ben Nun Kalev ben Yefuneh minat terms haaretz korubim gehem. They tore their clothing. Bayomru al kol das bnei Yisrael leimor aretz asher avanu v'lasuras advaretz maod maod. They said the land that we went through is a great land. Im chafetz banu Hashem v'biyu son al eretz hazon. No lanu eretz asher he's a vaschal v'dvash. If Hashem wants us and He's given us this land, then great. The nachba Hashem altam roda. Don't go against Hashem. And the people say, let's stone Kalev and Yehoshua. Okay, and Kalev and Yehoshua continue taking their stand, and there are arguments which are made. And they are, protecting in their own way Moshe and Aaron. And we see God's response to all of this as presented in the next few psukim. But if you skip to Pasuk Chafbez 22, you'll see God says, Chol anashim haro'im eskod yu yasav sosai shir sisi mitzvayim v'am barba inasiu sisi es bramim v'lo shamu b'koli. It says, all those who saw my wonders in Egypt, they've tested me 10 times. They haven't listened to me. I swear they're not going to see the land. That's a loose translation, by the way. And my servant Kalev, because he had a different spirit about him, he thought differently. He did not fall into the throes of the mob. And he followed my ways. It's unbelievable. Everybody thinks one way. Kalev thinks a different way. And God says, Kalev, you're my hero. It's unbelievable. And where's Yehoshua? Why is Yehoshua not mentioned there? Because Kalev took a stand. Kalev took a stand alone. And Yehoshua was not there. Now, Yehoshua did jump on the Kalev bandwagon. And if you look a few psukim later into Revi, you're going to see where God says that everybody's going to die in the land, everybody who's 20 and up. Pasuk Lamed. Im atem tavo el aretz asher nasasi yisadil asher ken eschem ba. Like nobody's going to be coming into the land. Ki im Kalev ben Yefuneh v'Yehoshua ben Nun. The only adults that are going to be coming into land are Kalev and Yehoshua. Your children will get to go into the land. However, you, Pigrechem, Atem, your skulls, Yeblu Bamidbar Azeh. That's it. You're all going to die. And by the way, is Moshe and Aaron singled out as not as surviving in the same way that Kalev and Yehoshua are being singled out? No. Moshe and Aaron are not being singled out. One would think that would be an important exclusion. Right, Moshe and Aaron, you're exempt from this one, but no, it's only Kalev and Yehoshua. Moshe and Aaron, what did they do when it came time to take the stand? They fell on their faces. They fell on their faces. Now, falling on your face could mean different things. They could be praying. They could be prostrating themselves before the Almighty. They could be giving up. They could be fainting. They could be passing out. They could be who knows what. Okay, now, I mean, this is not my idea. Barbanel is the one who says that Moshe's sin is the sin of the spies. Moshe doesn't get to go into the land on account of the way that this story panned out. And the fact that everybody's doomed to die and not going to the land. So Moshe's doomed to die and not going to the land. That's the way the Abarbanel puts it. But when you look at this story, you see that Kalev and Yeshua, yes, they are both mentioned here in Pasuk Lamed, but there's a major difference between Kalev and Yeshua. And you can skip to Pasuk Lamed Zayin, where it's actually really Pasuk Lamed Vav, where it just describes how they die. Vayamusu on Hashem, Abraham and Lamed Zayin 37, Vayamusu on Hashem Otsi Idi Basaratz Rabamagi Falif Ne Hashem. So the ones who spread the evil report about the land died in a plague before Hashem. What that plague was, subject of an interesting discussion, but anyway, except for who didn't die, Yehoshua ben Nun, Kaleb ben Yefune, Chayum, and Anashim Ayim Alchim Lasuris Arts, they lived from those people who went to spy the land. Okay, so now there's an interesting thing to consider, that when we look at Kalev and Yehoshua, both of them have a name change. The Gemara tells us that Kalev's name is not Kalev ben Yefune. You don't need the Gemara, you can look in Devar Hayyamim and you see that his name is Kalev ben Chetzron. So why is he called Kalev ben Yefune? Because Pina Atzmo Me'atzas Meraglin, which means that he turned himself away from the plan or the spies, whatever, however you want to translate Atzas, but their unified voice. He did that to himself. What about Yehoshua's name change? So mentioned at the outset that Yehoshua's name was Hoshea, and Moshe called him Yehoshua. Why does Moshe call him Yehoshua? Because Pasuk says, because I think it's Rashi who says, Ka Yoshiacha Me'atzas Meraglim. It's not Rashi who makes this up. Rashi gets this from somewhere else, but let me just make sure. Rashi says, Nispalel Alav Ya Yoshiacha Me'atzas Meraglim, it's the Gemara and Sota. Okay? So Moshe had to pray for Yehoshua that God should protect him from being part of the spies. Now, there are a lot of problems there, okay? If Moshe knew that the spies were going to be messing up, and he's praying for Yehoshua, why is he sending the spies? Why would you do that? If you know this is a mission doomed to failure, not because they're going to bring a bad report, because they're going to bring an honest report, and then they're going to chime in on it in a negative way, so why are you sending them? That's one question. I don't have an answer to that one. Okay, I'm thinking about it, but I don't have a good answer to that. And the other one is, so he's praying for Yehoshua, but he's not praying for Kalev. What is the difference between Yehoshua and Kalev in that Yehoshua and Kalev need different treatment from Moshe Rabbeinu? Okay? And I think it's so clear. When you consider, those who are in the Devarim class are familiar with this, one of the early things that we talked about in the Devarim class is the presentation of Kalev and Yehoshua in the very beginning of the book of Devarim. And I'm just going to quickly turn there, okay? And then I'm going to conclude with one final thought, because I have to be done in 4 minutes. But it's Perek Aleph, Pesukim, Lamed Hey, Lamed Vav, Lamed Zayin. There, Moshe is telling over the story to the next generation of who's going into the land. And he tells them about the spies. And he said at the time, God said, "In Yireh Ish b'Anashim Ha'Ilador Arazah," that nobody from this generation is going to see this land. "Es Haaretz HaTovah Asher Nishbati L'Seis L'Avoseichem," that the good land that I swore to give to your fathers. "Zulasi," except for "Kalev ben Yefuneh Hu Yirena." Kalev is going to see it. Velo, and to him, I'm going to give the land that he walked on, and to his children, because he filled exactly what Hashem said. Then Moshe throws a zinger at us, and he said, God also got angry at me, and said, you too are not going to go there. Moshe's talking about the spies. And Barbanel is totally on target. Moshe is not getting to go into the land because of the spies incident. What happens with the rock, different story. Not for now. Maybe we'll look at it in a couple weeks in Parshas Chukas. And then the next pasuk, Yehoshua ben Nun, Omed lefanecha, hu yavo shama. Yehoshua, who's standing before you, he's going to go into the land. Osoch hazeki yu en chilanas Yisrael. So it seems that Kalev is getting to go in on his merit, and Yehoshua is getting to go in on the merit that he's replacing Moshe Rabbeinu. So maybe he's getting to go in on his own merit. So what's the difference between Kalev and Yehoshua? So I think that Kalev and Yehoshua clearly represent two very different types of leadership. And those who were participating in the Pirkei Avos class, we talked about the difference between Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. It's the exact same kind of distinction which is being made. Elazar ben Azariah was a cistern. Everything that went into him, he just remembered. Never came up with a chiddush in his life. He just repeated everything from his rebbeim because he just captured everything that was told to him. Elazar ben Arach was a ma'ayan amizgaber, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, which means that he was the kind of person who was always strengthening his thought process and thinking on his own. Kalev clearly thinks on his own. And that is an amazing quality. What is Yehoshua? Yehoshua is the person who just repeats the best ideas. Moshe is his teacher, so he just repeats everything that Moshe says. Kalev, he hears Kalev do a great idea, so Yehoshua jumps on board. And it's not a knock on Yehoshua. These are two different qualities. Kalev doesn't become the leader of the Jewish people. Yehoshua does. But Kalev is a superstar. And it is possible as well that one of the reasons why Kalev is a superstar is because maybe here's just a possibility, which is a layover from last week's Parsha. And I just saw this, I don't remember who I saw this in the name of, but why did Kalev not need Moshe to pray for him? Because who's Kalev married to? Our tradition is that Kalev was married to Miriam. Okay, so he had a superstar wife. Yes, he had a superstar wife. But you know what else just happened to his wife? What happened at the end of Parshas Baaloscha? She said, Lashon Hara. I see you, Joan. You got it. Okay, I see you. You're silent. I got it. You're muted. Okay? She said, Lashon Hara, and had terrible repercussions. And Kalev comes in and says, whoa, let's take it slowly. Let's take it slowly. Let's analyze. Let's think about this. Let's think it through. Let's not make terrible mistakes. And I think that this is the takeaway lesson I wanted to leave you with, which is that there are different types of leadership and different types of ways of taking a stand. Kalev demonstrates one. Yehoshua demonstrates another. Kalev gets his reward and Yehoshua gets his reward. But ultimately, it's different ways of thinking. It's different ways of leadership. And each one has merit. And I would encourage people to consider that different ways of thinking is good. Different ways of thinking is good, and it should be embraced. And we are not seeing so much of that today. And we should see a lot more of it. So I want to wish you, that's my message for today. And I thank you for participating. The Devarim class will be